In May 1954, George Lucas Jr. turned 10, and that summer came a new addition to the Lucas home that would change his life forever. Television. For his first 10 years, George, like millions of Americans at the time, would sit on the floor in front of the radio, mesmerized by radio dramas, many of which used incredibly elaborate and convincing sound effects. "I've always been fascinated by the fantasy of radio," Lucas said later. "I loved to listen and imagine what the images would look like." He was particularly fond of suspenseful thrillers like Inner Sanctum and The Whistler, as well as adventures like The Lone Ranger. "Radio," he said, "played an important part in my life, but it would be nothing compared to television." John Plummer had actually gotten a television set first. In 1949, Plummer's father brought home a little Champion TV set, which he put in the garage, then constructed a small set of bleachers so neighbors could crowd around to watch boxing. George's own father was intrigued, but skeptical. He would wait a few years for the technology to improve before he made an investment in such an expensive device. While George Jr. would watch as much television as he could over at the Plummer house, he would have to wait 5 more years for a TV of his own. Once he had one, however, he wasn't quite sure what to do with it. The problem, as Lucas remembered it, was that there wasn't much to watch on television. Still, the Modesto Bee dutifully reported the television schedules each day, listing the fare shown on channels like KJEO from Fresno and KOVR from Sacramento, both of which had signals too weak to be picked up clearly in Modesto. It took patience and a bit of finesse to tune in the few stations with stronger signals, mainly KRON from San Francisco and KTVU from Stockton. But once Lucas had tuned them in, he didn't want to tune out, ever. Like generations of kids, Lucas would get up on Saturday morning to watch cartoons, sitting cross-legged in front of the set with his cat, Dinky. The set could be on all day, rolling through game shows and newscasts, baseball games and comedies, and George Sr. had very carefully installed it on a rotating stand so the family could turn the TV toward the dining room to watch as they ate dinner. In the evenings, it was tuned to more serious fare, like the courtroom drama Perry Mason, or westerns like Have Gun, Will Travel, which Lucas never missed. But the TV shows that Lucas remembered the most fondly were those 30-minute blocks of local programming in the late afternoon and early evening that broadcasters, looking for content, simply filled with installments of old movie serials. There were westerns and jungle adventures, cops and Canadian Mounties, spies and space operas, all in 30-minute installments practically made for television, and ending on cliffhangers, guaranteeing that viewers would tune in the next afternoon. "Movie serials were the real standout event," said Lucas. "I especially loved the Flash Gordon serials." Produced by Universal in the 1930s, the 3 Flash Gordon serials, based on Alex Raymond's beloved comic strip, were quickly and cheaply made, with props, sets, and costumes borrowed from other Universal horror and science fiction films. And they were straight-ahead pulp fiction fun, eye-rolling and over-the-top but earnest, with Flash battling Ming the Merciless and saving the galaxy in the process. "Thinking back on what I really enjoyed as a kid, it was those serials, that bizarre way of looking at things," said Lucas. "I don't think I ever grew out of it. Those serials will always be something I remember, even though they were pretty awful, technically." Lucas was part of the first generation raised in front of the TV set, a pop culture phenomenon that would forever change the way audiences related and responded to their entertainment. TV shows were quick, convenient, and disposable, there with the click of an on button and a twist of the dial. With only 30 or 60-minute blocks in which to tell a story, and commercials breaking up the narrative, TV plots had to move rapidly, propelling the plot forward, often at the expense of character development. Attention spans were demanding, and any lag in the action would send viewers spinning the TV dial to another channel, looking for something better. As television grew louder and faster, subtlety became passé, or at the very least, challenging. It would fundamentally change the way Lucas and other filmmakers of his generation would tell stories with the movie camera. For the first time, too, one didn't have to go to a movie theater to watch movies. Instead, George could watch them in his own living room, spinning the TV around toward the dining room to ensure he never missed a moment. Lucas remembered watching a whole run of Westerns on television, John Wayne films, directed by John Ford, before I knew who John Ford was, adding, "I think those were very influential in my enjoyment of movies." As for seeing movies in the theater, well, Lucas rarely went. We had a couple of theaters in Modesto. They'd show The Blob and Lawrence of Arabia and things like that. But he was unimpressed. Even as a teenager, Lucas was more interested in what was going on inside the theater than up on the screen. "I would mostly go to the movies to chase girls," he admitted. While Lucas recalled seeing a few memorable films either on TV or in the Modesto movie theaters, Forbidden Planet, Metropolis, The Bridge on the River Kwai, for the most part, movies were simply a pleasant diversion, not an inspiration. The young Lucas may have been ambivalent about movies, but there was one entertainment, in fact, one place he was very passionate about. "I loved Disneyland," Lucas said, and so it seemed did George Lucas Sr., who flew the entire family to Southern California to be there for the park's opening day in July 1955. The Lucases remained in Anaheim for a week, staying at the Disneyland Hotel and diving into the park daily, a practice they would make a regular tradition. With its themed, immersive locations and rides, the place made an immediate impression on 11-year-old George. "I wandered around. I'd go on the rides and the bumper cars, the steamboats, the shooting galleries, the jungle rides," he said. "I was in heaven." Disneyland in the 1950s was a far cry from the thrill ride and roller coaster centric park it is today, but no one, then or now, designed attractions quite like Disney's famous Imagineers. One of the cleverest rides was Rocket to the Moon, luring in visitors with the promise of a virtual trip to the moon and back. The mechanics were simple but convincing. Riders sat in a small, round theater with enormous windows, actually video screens, set into the floor and ceiling, giving them the sense they were seeing the open sky and the moon through the window above, and the diminishing Earth through the window below, as they rocketed through space. Decades later, when Lucas was given the opportunity to develop a Star Wars-themed ride for the Disney parks, he would use a setup similar to Rocket to the Moon, video screens acting as windows in a spaceship, then synchronize those on-screen images with state-of-the-art motion technology to give riders an even more convincing and exhilarating space travel experience. For now, however, Disney's rocket ride was thrilling enough, and back in Modesto, the boy who hated writing set to work excitedly reporting his adventures at Disneyland for a new local newspaper. The newspaper was the Daily Bugle, and it was one that Lucas had helped start that summer with a 10-year-old friend, Melvin Cellini. After watching a TV show in which several characters tried to come up with a name for a newspaper, Cellini had been inspired to create a paper of his own and sought out Lucas as a willing collaborator. Their first issue, which Lucas and Cellini distributed for free at Muir Elementary School on August 4th, announced itself with a banner headline declaring, "Melvin Cellini opens a newspaper, appoints George Lucas star reporter." The boys were enthusiastic, but producing a daily newspaper, including printing 100 copies of each issue, was a lot of work. "Paper will be given out Monday to Friday," they reported, "but this Friday it won't be out because the press broke down." Lucas, whose do-it-all-yourself instincts were already kicking in, quickly talked his father into letting them use the printing presses down at L.M. Morris for the Bugle, promising to repay any expenses. But in less than a week, the novelty had worn off. "The Daily Bugle stops," they reported to their readers. "The Weekly Bugle will be put out on Wednesday only. There is the same news." And, they stressed, they weren't hiring. "We need no reporters, printers, or newsboys. No subscriptions taken." Despite its struggles, a kid-run newspaper was enough of a novelty that it made the pages of the Modesto Bee, complete with a posed photo of George and Cellini leaning over an issue of the Weekly Bugle, deep in conversation. Lucas, his hair in a close crew cut and wearing a breezy tropical print shirt, already knew the prop needed to sell his image as the Bugle's star reporter, and had tucked a newly sharpened pencil smartly behind his right ear. The Bugle soon folded, but if Cellini was disappointed by the lost revenues he had predicted from selling about 200 copies a week at a penny per issue, Lucas never gave it another thought. He wasn't in it for the money, he told the Bee. Anything he earned from the Bugle he planned to put right back into the newspaper, paying any delivery boys and reimbursing L.M. Morris for the costs of paper, ink, and stencils. While Lucas may not have realized or appreciated it, his father and Scrooge McDuck had taught him well. Think differently, believe in yourself, and when you can, invest in yourself, but pay your debts. Lucas showed similar business acumen when it came to managing his allowance. Under George Sr.'s roof, money was to be earned, and George Jr. and his sisters were expected to do chores in exchange for their allowances. George Jr.'s big weekly chore was to mow the lawn with a gigantic rotary push mower, a task he struggled with and quickly came to dread. The frustrating thing was that it was tough grass to mow, and I was a little kid, Lucas said. He eventually saved enough money from mowing so that, with a small loan from his mother, he was able to buy a gas mower, which made the task much easier. Lucas had figured out what he needed to solve a problem, and then put up his own money to do it. Invest in yourself. His father was grudgingly impressed. But as well-intentioned as George Sr. might be, doling out allowances with lectures on frugality and hard work, he and his son would never quite appreciate each other. He never listened to me. He was his mother's pet, said George Sr. of his only son. If he wanted a camera, or this or that, he got it. He was hard to understand. The more George Sr. tried to impart his old-school Methodist values to his son, the more his son rebelled or frustrated him. He is a conservative, self-made kind of man, Lucas said of his father, with a lot of prejudices which were extremely annoying. For George Sr., tensions between father and son must have been particularly frustrating, especially as the company that he was hoping to pass down to his son was thriving. In 1956, in fact, business was positively booming. That year, George Sr. moved L.M. Morris to a new space at 1107 I Street, the company's first address change in five decades, and opened the Lucas Company, the area's only supplier of the new copying machines. With the company growing, George Sr. also went looking for a more suitably upscale home address. The house on Ramona Avenue was sold, and the Lucases moved into a ranch house with a swimming pool on 13 sprawling acres of walnut trees at 821 Sylvan Road. The new Lucas home was only about 5 miles away from Ramona Avenue, but in Modesto miles, and to George, it might as well have been another planet. Lucas was very upset about the move, he said later. I was very attached to that Ramona Avenue house. His mood blackened. He started changing, recalled John Plummer. He started paying more attention to records. He was becoming more introspective. He started to almost become a little bit of a ruffian, to follow some of the bad kids. Lucas bristled at that particular suggestion. I was with all the crowds, he said. I was little and I was funny. I was easy to get along with. I'd made friends pretty easily, or so he thought. What was true, however, was that Lucas, like millions of teenagers, had discovered rock and roll. Lucas had taken music lessons on a wide variety of instruments, and while nothing ever stuck, he loved music. As a child, he adored the marches of John Philip Sousa, intuitively realizing the importance of themes and loving the way a good, loud march could thrum excitingly in the chest cavity. But his life changed in September 1956 when Elvis Presley swaggered and snarled his way through four songs on The Ed Sullivan Show. When Elvis performed in San Francisco in October 1957, Lucas was there. For Lucas, rock and roll, and Elvis, was here to stay. Every day after school, Lucas would shut himself in his new room on Sylvan, read his beloved comics, and eat Hershey bars and drink Cokes, while rock and roll throbbed from his little record player. Over the next decade, he would amass a gigantic collection of rock and roll records. Once Lucas began classes at Thomas Downey High School in 1958, his best grades, perhaps predictably, were in art and music. Otherwise, he quietly sank toward the bottom half of his class. "I was not a bad student. I was an average student," Lucas explained. "I was a C, sometimes a C-minus student. I was definitely not an achiever." That was putting it mildly. By the end of his freshman year, he was getting D's in science and English. "I daydreamed a lot," Lucas said later. "I was never described as not a bright student. I was always described as somebody who could be doing a lot better than I was doing, not working up to potential. I was so bored." His real classroom was probably back at home, where Lucas took up photography and converted a spare bathroom in the new house into a darkroom. He taught himself the basics, shooting airplanes as they soared overhead, and eventually becoming savvy enough that he could catch his cat frozen in mid-leap. Just as his classes had taken a backseat to art and music, his photography would vie for time with a new passion that would take up nearly all of his next 6 years, and would very nearly take his life. "My teenage years, they were completely devoted to cars," recalled Lucas. "That was the most important thing in my life from about the ages of 14 to 20. It was motorcycles first, which the 13-year-old Lucas would ride at a breakneck speed, engine roaring, tires squealing, through the rows of walnut trees on the Sylvan Ranch. "I've always liked speed," he admitted later. "At 15, cars kicked in," said Lucas. "I started hanging out at a garage, doodling with cars and working on engines." He was good at it, too. The kid who had tinkered with toy trains and made a roller coaster run with a reel of phone cable found himself right at home under the hood of a car. It wasn't long before Lucas was yearning for a car of his own, and George Sr., who had already watched his son race dangerously around the ranch on a motorcycle, made a preemptive purchase that he thought was in his speed demon son's best interest. A tiny yellow Fiat Bianchina with a two-cylinder engine. He figured that would be safe because it couldn't go that fast, Lucas said. But the engine, he groaned, was a sewing machine motor. It was a dumb little car. What could I do with that? It was practically a motor scooter. What he could do was take it apart and, after making a few adjustments, put it back together again. "I made it extremely fast," Lucas said proudly. "I'd race around the orchard and spin out and smash it up. Then he'd start all over again, hauling his car down to Foreign Car Service, a local garage that specialized in European cars, where he'd rebuild the Fiat, cutting off the roof and lowering the front windshield to a mere sliver, punching up the engine, installing a racing belt and roll bar, and tinkering with the suspension. Like Han Solo's Millennium Falcon, Lucas's Bianchina wouldn't look like much, but it would have it where it counted. And he would make a lot of the special modifications himself. In May 1960, George Lucas turned 16. There would be no more spinning out and smashing up the Bianchina in the walnut groves. Now, Lucas said, I could really drive around, out on the streets. School, never a priority, was all but forgotten. I wasn't paying much attention at high school, he admitted later. I found it all pretty boring and spent all my free time working on my car. From that point on, said Lucas, cars were all-consuming to me. As his grades suffered, Lucas began to look more and more like the juvenile delinquent his teachers were already convinced he was. The crew cut was grown out, and Lucas combed and greased his hair back in the style everyone called a duck's ass, or sculpted his already wavy hair upward into a shiny California variation on the pompadour called the Breaker. Lucas didn't develop a lot of the bad habits typical of actual thugs. He wasn't a drinker, and his biggest vice was gorging himself on Hershey bars. But he definitely looked the part, wearing unwashed Levi's and pointy-toed boots with metal tips. At only 5'6", however, Lucas seemed more surly than intimidating, and John Plummer thought his friend simply looked lost, hanging out with the undesirables and lowriders of the town. By reputation alone, one of the biggest groups of undesirables and lowriders in Modesto were members of a car club known as the Pharaohs. Their nightly objectives, as one member later described it, were simple: girls, beer, and cars. They were probably more swagger than threat. By their own admission, there was little smoking or swearing, but they looked dangerous and could always find their share of trouble with rival gangs and car clubs. Lucas, who had already made a habit of befriending older and stronger protectors, hovered around the Pharaohs, though more as a mascot than as a full-fledged member. The only way to keep from getting the shit pounded out of you was to hang out with some really rough guys who happened to be your friends, he said. Mostly, the Pharaohs saw Lucas as the perfect decoy for churning up rival gangs, then luring them right into the Pharaohs' waiting fists. They'd send me in and wait until somebody would try to pick a fight with me. Then they would come in and pound them, said Lucas. I was the bait. I was always afraid I was going to get pounded myself. For Lucas, however, being out on the street was never about fighting. Having his own car meant two things: racing and cruising. And Modesto, with its streets laid out in long grids, was ideal for both. George was addicted to cruising more than anyone, I think, recalled Plummer. For Lucas, cruising was more than an addiction. It was a very distinctive American mating ritual, he said later. It's very unique because it's all done in cars. The ritual was elaborate but predictable. Usually, Lucas and his fellow cruisers would troll down 10th Street, dragging 10th, they called it, then cut one block east over to 11th Street, where they would cruise back up before cutting over to 10th again, round and round all night. At times, they'd park at the drive-in, order food, and move from car to car, blasting Buddy Holly or Chuck Berry, chatting through open windows, or, if one got lucky, sliding into the back seat for a quick makeout session. It was a ritual that began to consume nearly all of Lucas's waking hours. It was the main entertainment, sort of just going around in circles chasing girls all night, said Lucas. You'd come in at 4 a.m, get a couple hours of sleep, and go off to school. Despite his regular efforts, however, Lucas didn't actually catch that many girls. I never really had any high school kind of girlfriends or anything, he said. I was always going around picking up girls and hoping for the best. While he allegedly lost his virginity in the backseat of a car, he seemed to enjoy the chase, the ritual, more than the conquest. Cruising is like fishing, Lucas explained later. Unless you happen to catch a shark, there are no real great moments. Mostly it's just sitting around talking, having a good time. Occasionally you get a fish, but it's never that exciting. What was exciting, though, was racing. With his souped-up Bianchina, Lucas was a force to be reckoned with on Modesto's long straightaways. The little car was now built for speed, low and lightweight, with a driver who still weighed barely 100 pounds. George could drive him, said Plummer admiringly. He was really good at that. Lucas loved gunning the engine, then peeling rubber through all four gears with 3 shifts. It was the thrill of doing something really well. It was no wonder the Modesto police found him an easy target, issuing him so many speeding tickets that he eventually had to appear in court, and in a dreaded suit, no less. After his immersion in the car scene, Lucas now knew what he wanted to do with his life. He didn't just want to race Modesto's back roads, he wanted to drive a race car for a living. Unfortunately, California law prohibited him from officially racing until he reached the age of 21. So Lucas made the rounds at Northern California autocross events instead, putting his little Fiat through its paces on tightly controlled parking lot or airfield courses marked out with red cones. He even managed to win a few trophies, giving him bragging rights among the other car enthusiasts at the Foreign Car Service garage. But there was an autocross driver at Foreign Car Service who was even better than Lucas, a fellow Modestan named Alan Grant, 4 years older than George, who seemed never to lose a race. Lucas, who loved speed, was impressed. "Since I was the fastest driver, George took a liking to me, and we became friends," said Grant. In Grant, Lucas had found yet another big brother figure to whom he could attach himself. He joined Grant as his mechanic and, when needed, co-driver. As they leaned over the engine of Grant's car, Lucas could quickly make Grant and the rest of the Foreign Car Service crew a bit crazy. He was always jabbering, "What about this? And doing this?" said Grant. "And you know, we didn't take him very seriously. But we liked him." The racing community gave Lucas some much-needed structure. It wasn't school, but it was social, organized, and respectable in an underground way. Lucas joined the newly formed Écurie AWOL Sports Car Competition Club, created almost solely so its members could compete at autocross, and edited its newsletter, writing its lead commentaries and filling its pages with drawings of cars. And he got his first real job, working as a mechanic at Foreign Car Service. He still looked like a greaser, but he was acting more like a professional grease monkey now, fixing cars, rebuilding engines, and acting as Grant's pit crew at the races Grant seemed to win almost effortlessly. It wasn't all cruising and racing, however. "A car also gave Lucas my own life," he said. "Freedom to explore the world beyond Modesto." What he saw intrigued him. For one thing, there were art house cinemas showing films he'd never heard of, their marquees glowing with strange and glamorous titles like Les Quatre Cents Coups or A Bout de Souffle, and directors with names that were exotic to him, like Truffaut and Godard. With their existential themes, social relevance, frequently jittery camera movement, and a self-awareness in which characters often directly addressed the audience, these and other films of the so-called French New Wave just felt different from any of the films Lucas had seen at Modesto's Strand Theater. "I love the style of Godard's films," Lucas would say later. "The graphics, this sense of humor, the way he portrayed the world, he was very cinematic." In 1962, Lucas couldn't quite articulate what he thought of the cresting French New Wave films. He just knew that they were something very different from The Blob or Cinder Fella. Lucas and John Plummer were also making regular trips north to the Berkeley area to attend the recently founded Canyon Cinema, a floating cinematheque established by avant-garde filmmaker Brice Bailly and several other like-minded colleagues to showcase underground, experimental, and avant-garde films. Lucas had never seen anything like it. Bailly had set up the original Canyon Cinema in his Canyon, California backyard, serving free popcorn and wine as he projected movies from his kitchen window onto an army surplus screen. At other times and locations, films might simply be projected onto sheets. While Bailly was promoting largely local filmmakers whose films had little chance of making it into theaters, films by foreign directors like Federico Fellini, Ingmar Bergman, and Jonas Mackus often crept into the rotation as well. Lucas found them all interesting, but he liked the more avant-garde films best, the ones that were more abstract in nature. Lucas would drive back to Modesto in his Bianchina after a screening, head swimming with images and sounds. His parents knew nothing of it, not of dragging 10th all night, nor the autocross races with Alan Grant, nor the art films in San Francisco. "He just disappeared in the evenings," said his sister Wendy. Lucas thought his father's lack of interest in him was typical, and looking back, probably understandable. "I was a hellraiser," Lucas said. "I didn't do very well in school. My father thought I was going to be an automobile mechanic, and that I wasn't going to amount to anything. My parents, not my mother, mothers never write off their sons, but my father wrote me off." The powder keg of tension between father and son finally exploded when Lucas was 18. Both knew that the fuse had been lit and sputtering for a long time. Lucas, however, in addition to the long hair, bad grades, and nighttime disappearing act that already so irritated his father, hadn't done himself any favors when he, truculently and briefly, went to work for George Sr. at L.M. Morris. Lucas hated dragging around gigantic boxes, sweeping the floors, cleaning the toilets. He even hated getting into his Bianchina to deliver packages. And so Lucas had quit, and his father was furious. Lucas was furious, too. I got really mad at my father and told him I'll never work in a job where I have to do the same thing over and over again every day. And he just didn't want to hear that, said Lucas. The argument was on. He had worked very hard to be able to give this family business to me, and so for me to refuse it was a big deal, Lucas said. He thought that I would go off and starve to death as some kind of artist living in a garret. You'll be back in a few years, George Sr. told his son knowingly. I'll never be back, Lucas shot back. And as a matter of fact, I'm going to be a millionaire before I'm 30. Recalling their spat 40 years later, well after he'd become one of the most successful and wealthy businessmen in the world, Lucas could only smile at the irony of telling off his own prosperous entrepreneur father, as well as his own surprising resolve. We had this big break when he wanted me to go into the business and I refused, Lucas said in 1997. And I told him, there are two things I know for sure. One is that I will end up doing something with cars, and two, that I will never be president of a company. I guess I got outwitted. For now, Lucas would only concede that he was willing to finish high school before leaving L.M. Morris and maybe Modesto behind for good. He and Plummer were already planning to spend the summer in Europe, perhaps heading for France to watch Le Mans, or to Germany, where they could roar down the Autobahn without any regard for speed limits. After that, Lucas would go to art school, which earned another scowl of disapproval from his father and another round of arguments, or become a full-time mechanic or race car driver. But first, he had to graduate from Thomas Downey High School. And as his June graduation date approached, even that was looking less and less likely. With only a few weeks left of school, Lucas was failing several classes, and with final exams looming, he still had 3 term papers to turn in. Flunking out was a very real possibility. Then on June 12, 1962, a sweltering hot Tuesday, with his graduation only 3 days away, Lucas piled into his Bianchina with an armload of school books and headed for the library, about 20 minutes away, where he planned to spend the afternoon studying for finals and writing the papers that were still due. Predictably, it didn't take him long to get bored, and at about 4:30 p.m. or so, Lucas climbed back into his little car and pointed it toward home. By 4:50, he was hurtling down Sylvan Road with the dirt road entrance to the Lucas Ranch coming up on his left. Lucas slowed the Bianchina to a crawl, then began to ease the little Fiat into a left turn. Lucas neither saw nor heard the Chevy Impala, driven by 17-year-old Frank Ferreira, roaring up the road from the opposite direction. As Lucas turned across Sylvan, Ferreira's Impala T-boned the little Fiat, hitting it fast and hard. The Bianchina rolled several times, then smashed into an enormous walnut tree, wrapping itself around the trunk in a mangled metal death grip. Lucas's carefully juiced-up engine tumbled from the car's shattered husk, dripping oil and radiator fluid onto the hard-baked Modesto soil. Chapter 2 Geeks and Nerds, 1962 through 1966. Inside the Lucas house, Dorothy Lucas heard the squeal of tires and the sickening sound of the Bianchina rolling and then crashing into the walnut tree. For my parents, it was devastating, because it was right at the end of their road, and my mother heard it, recalled Kate Lucas. And she went down to see what had happened. It was her son. The wreckage was terrible. A photograph of it would run on the front page of the Modesto Bee the next morning, but miraculously, Lucas wasn't inside the car when it hurtled into the tree. As the Bianchina rolled for the third time, Lucas's racing belt, the one he had so carefully installed himself, bolting it to the floor of the car with a thick metal plate, failed and snapped. He was flung clear of the car just before impact, landing on his chest and stomach with such force that he was immediately knocked unconscious. As he hit the ground, Lucas's left scapula fractured and his lungs were bruised. His heart rate plummeted and he went into shock. He had been hurt badly, but had his racing belt held, he would have been mangled and likely killed inside the Bianchina, which hit the walnut tree hard enough to leave it leaning at a 45-degree angle, roots torn and exposed. An ambulance arrived, sirens blaring, and Lucas was rushed to Modesto City Hospital a short distance away. En route, Lucas's color went from pale to blue, and he started to vomit blood. An open gash in his forehead continued to bleed, smearing blood across his face and staining his shirt collar crimson. It didn't look good. And on Lucas's arrival at the hospital, the facility's ace diagnostician, Dr. Paul Carlson, was hastily called in to determine the extent of his injuries. To Carlson's surprise, Lucas was actually in better shape than he looked. While there was some hemorrhaging from his bruised lungs, further testing showed no other internal bleeding. And apart from a few minor fractures, everything else was intact. When Lucas awoke several hours later, he found himself in a hospital bed with an oxygen tube in his nose and several more tubes attached to a needle in his arm, where he was receiving a blood transfusion. His mother, who had nearly fainted at the sight of his injuries, stood nearby with his sister Wendy. Groggily, Lucas could only ask, "Mom, did I do something wrong?" Dorothy Lucas burst into tears. Lucas's smashed Fiat was dragged onto a flatbed truck and hauled off for junk. "Most of the kids at school thought I had died," said Lucas later. "My car was this little mangled hulk that was driven down the main street where I cruised. Everybody thought I'd been killed." His teachers at Thomas Downey High School took pity on what they thought for certain was a doomed young man. "All the teachers that were going to flunk me gave me a D," said Lucas. "So I managed to get my diploma by virtue of the fact that everybody thought I was going to be dead in 3 weeks anyway." Lucas would spend most of the next 4 months in bed, recuperating from his injuries. He did a lot of thinking about the accident, about life, and about the universe and his place in it. It wasn't lost on him that he'd been saved by the failure of the very racing belt he had installed to protect himself. "I realized more than anything else what a thin thread we hang on in life," Lucas said, "and I really wanted to make something out of my life." It was similar to the existential crisis he'd experienced at age 6. "What am I? How do I function in this? And what's going on here?" Only now it seemed he might finally be on his way to finding some answers. "I was in an accident that, in theory, no one could survive," he said. "So it was like, well, I'm here, and every day now is an extra day. I've been given an extra day, so I've got to make the most of it." And then, the next day, I began with 2 extra days. You can't help in that situation but get into a mindset like that. You've been given this gift, and every single day is a gift. And I wanted to make the most of it. It was, he said later, like almost starting a new life. The question of what to do with that new life, then, was not to be taken lightly. Driving a race car, however, was probably out of the question. Before that first accident, you are very oblivious to the danger because you don't realize how close to the edge you are, said Lucas. But once you've gone over the edge and you realize what's on the other side, it changes your perspective. You see what the future is there in racing, and you realize that you'll probably end up being dead. And I just decided that maybe that wasn't for me. Lucas would always love cars, but his racing days were over, and I was going to have to figure out something else to do, he said, if I didn't want to be a car mechanic. And so, in the fall of 1962, the young man who had never given his studies much thought decided to go back to school, enrolling in Modesto Junior College. which was fairly easy to get into, Lucas noted. With his new outlook, he vowed to apply myself at school, a choice of words his father likely approved of, even if he thought his son was wasting his time taking arts and humanities courses. Now that Lucas was in charge of his own educational destiny and no longer subject to the requirements of the California public school system, he could choose courses that truly interested him. Sociology, anthropology, psychology. Stuff you didn't get in high school, Lucas said. These were things I was really interested in and that sparked me. Though he admitted, it was very hard and I didn't have the background I needed. I couldn't even spell. For the first time, Lucas was taking a genuine interest in school. John Plummer noticed the change in his friend immediately. You could see he was now a serious student and those things, sociology and anthropology, really meant something to him. Lucas worked hard and was proud of his efforts. I was into something I really cared about, and my whole grade situation just turned around, he said. I had thought I was a terrible student, and then suddenly I was a great student. Great was perhaps relative. While he received an A in astronomy and B's in speech, sociology, and art history, his grades were mostly C's. Still, all things considered, it was a remarkable turnaround. Lucas received his Associate in Arts degree from Modesto Junior College on June 9, 1964. While anthropology had been his primary academic focus over the previous 2 years, Lucas had also become more serious about illustration and photography, and he was determined to go to art school, preferably the Art Center College of Design in Pasadena. There was one person, however, who had a problem with that particular plan, George Lucas Sr., who made it abundantly clear that there would be no artists in the Lucas family, especially if he was bankrolling it. No way, George Sr. told his son flatly. I'm not going to pay for that. Do it on your own if you want. You'll never make a living as an artist. Lucas knew that his father, with the power of the checkbook behind him, had him outgunned. Aware, I think, that I'm basically a lazy person, Lucas said. My father knew I wouldn't go to art school if I had to work my way through. Boxed in, Lucas decided to apply instead to San Francisco State University, which was tuition-free, like most of California's state-funded institutions at the time, to pursue a major in anthropology, the one academic subject for which he had a genuine passion. That plan at least met with his father's approval, and Lucas's grades at junior college were good enough for San Francisco State to accept him. His path seemed set. And then, almost immediately, it suddenly wasn't. It was partly John Plummer's fault. That summer, Plummer had decided to apply to business school at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles and invited Lucas to accompany him to Stockton to take USC's entrance examination. Lucas scowled. What am I going to do down there? Plummer explained that USC had a cinematography school, which Plummer thought sounded close enough to photography for Lucas to find it interesting. Lucas was interested. Cinematography sounded so much more serious than art school that it just might meet with his father's approval. So he drove to Stockton and took the entrance exams. And I applied, said Lucas. While Plummer had assured him that the entrance exam was easy and that the cinematography program would be even easier, Lucas wasn't so sure. I didn't think I'd get in, because even though my grades had come up considerably in junior college, I didn't think they were good enough. Lucas bought a silver Camaro that summer, ready for his fall relocation, though whether it would be to San Francisco or Los Angeles, he didn't yet know. And while he had sworn off racing, that didn't mean he had forsworn cars altogether. From time to time, he would still hang around with Alan Grant, loitering in the pits and helping him prepare his car for races. At this point, however, Lucas was more likely to photograph the race, or better yet, film the speeding cars and their drivers using a small 8mm camera his father had given him. And while shadowing Grant, Lucas was introduced to another racing fan who knew his way around a movie camera, cinematographer Haskell Wexler. The 42-year-old Wexler had recently wrapped the Henry Fonda political drama The Best Man, and was prepping his civil rights documentary, The Bus, for a 1965 release. Between films, Wexler headed his own racing team, and he was in the pits when a crew member steered Lucas his way. Talking cars and photography together, Lucas and Wexler quickly struck up a friendship, another older brother figure Lucas could attach himself to and learn from. And Lucas mentioned that he had recently applied to USC and was nervous about his prospects. Wexler promised to call a friend of his at the university and ask him to keep an eye out for the kid from Modesto. I sensed a guy who had a burning desire to explore unique visual graphics, filmic things, Wexler said later. Lucas learned of his admission to USC shortly thereafter. While the story would be retold later with Wexler pulling strings to get Lucas into USC, the timing was coincidental. Even Wexler himself would say that he had only encouraged Lucas to go to film school. Lucas, to his great surprise and credit, had passed the entrance exam and gotten into USC on his own merits. But he would later remember and repay Wexler's support. The decision to attend USC met with the approval of George Sr. as well. It had a solid reputation, and while it might be a bit too liberal for his taste, it was still a private school. As a private school, in fact, USC wasn't free, but Lucas's father agreed to pay for his son's tuition, as well as books and fees, and even send along monthly spending money, on the condition that Lucas take school seriously and treat it like a job. Failure, he made clear to his son, meant Modesto and L.M. Morris. So intent was the senior Lucas on teaching his son a life lesson that he hardly seemed to notice his son's declared major, just as Lucas had predicted. I couldn't be an art major, that would have upset my father, but cinema, that's obscure enough, said Lucas. He didn't know what it was, and he didn't care, as long as I wasn't in the art department. Or at least as long as he didn't read too far into the school's description. Lucas would be enrolled in USC's Division of Cinema at the School of Performing Arts. There weren't many film schools in the United States in the mid-1960s, but the three largest and best were located at USC, at New York University in Manhattan, and at USC's crosstown rival, UCLA. The program at USC was the country's oldest and largest, founded by the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences in 1929, with a founding faculty that included some of Hollywood's biggest names, including actor Douglas Fairbanks and producer Irving Thalberg. It took its curriculum seriously and embraced new media without bias. It began offering television courses as early as 1947, and by the late 1950s, offered the nation's only PhD in film studies. The school was highly regarded for turning out educational films and documentaries. In 1956, cinema instructor Wilbur T. Bloom had even won an Academy Award for Best Live-Action Short Film for The Face of Lincoln. Without quite meaning to, Lucas had chosen well. But even more than the school's professors, it was the other students he met and access to movie-making equipment that really set him off running. In midsummer, Lucas packed his Camaro and headed for Los Angeles to stay with John Plummer in an apartment Plummer was renting in Malibu. Before classes started in the fall, Lucas planned to spend some time working in restaurants near the beach, drawing girls for money if he was lucky, and picking some up if he was even luckier, and looking for summer work in the film industry. He would be disappointed. Every film company door he banged on along Ventura Boulevard was closed in his face. Film was strictly an old boys' network, an insider's game, closed off to those with no industry connections, relations, or contacts. Everyone I went into, I said I was looking for a job and I'd do anything, said Lucas. No luck. What was more frustrating was that Lucas actually did have a connection in the film industry. Haskell Wexler. The seasoned cinematographer, already a fan of Lucas's in only a brief amount of time, had allowed Lucas to hang out that summer at his own commercial film company, Dove Films, to watch movies being made. But not even Wexler could get Lucas a job working in his own company unless Lucas was in the union. Lucas, never a joiner, and with an antipathy to unions learned from his conservative father, bristled. It was another lesson he wouldn't soon forget. To get into the movie machine, one had to be part of the system, and Lucas had already decided he didn't like the system, or the machine, for that matter. I was disposed against it, mainly because of my first experience trying to get a job with Haskell and not being able to, Lucas said in 1971, still smarting from the rejection. Being shut out, I thought that was extremely unfair. When it came down to it, going to film school didn't seem like a way into the system either. At that time, nobody from a film school in the United States had ever worked in the film industry, said Lucas. If you went to film school, it was a silly thing to do because you would never get a job. The only people who ended up there were people who loved movies. So there was this underground movement of film nerds who weren't going to amount to anything. As far as we knew, the studios didn't know we existed. That was likely true. At that time, a degree in film meant nothing to the studios. Getting a job was hard enough. Getting one working on a feature film was nearly impossible. Most students assumed they would probably make documentaries, commercials, or industrial films after graduation, if, that is, they worked in film at all. Even USC's most famous alumnus at that time, 41-year-old director Irvin Kershner, had scratched and clawed his way from government documentaries to television before finally getting a break from Schlockmeister Roger Corman to direct Stakeout on Dope Street in 1958, then sliding into respectability with A Face in the Rain in 1963. It was a long road to success. Lucas's classmate Walter Murch, later an Academy Award-winning editor and sound designer, remembered being given the frank lay of the land his first day at USC. The very first thing our film teacher told us was, "Get out of this business now. There's no future in it. There are no jobs for any of you. Don't do this." Lucas, too, heard the same grumbling and naysaying. "But I wasn't moved by that," he said. "I set the goal of getting through film school, and just then focused on getting to that. I didn't know where I was going to go after that." But he knew that everybody was thinking I was silly. Lucas's father, while giving tight-lipped approval to his son's curriculum, worried he'd never find a real job, and still had the doors of the Lucas Company propped open to welcome the prodigal son back home to Modesto. Lucas had even taken a razzing from the guys in the pits at the racetrack. "I lost a lot of face," Lucas said, "because for hot rodders, the idea of going into film was a really goofy idea." Lucas came into USC's film school as a junior in the fall of 1964. If he was expecting the campus to possess even a touch of Hollywood glamour, he was surely disappointed. Despite its long tenure at USC, the film school appeared to have been glued onto the outer edges of the USC campus, almost as an afterthought, accessible through an ornate Spanish gate and squeezed between the main campus and a girls' dormitory. And the buildings containing the classrooms themselves were famously low rent, a smattering of Quonset huts and a group of bungalows built with lumber salvaged from World War I Army barracks. "In a way," said one USC film school dean, "it looked like a lot of movie studios." It had the feel of them, with its little corridors and wings and adjacencies. The story department was here, the editing department there, the soundstage around the corner, and so on. That didn't necessarily make them any more appealing. Even Steven Spielberg, who attended Long Beach State, 25 miles away, was well acquainted with the school's lack of charm. "A cinema ghetto," Spielberg said with a shudder. "The film equivalent of housing in the South Bronx." And yet, something about the school's ragtag, run-down appearance also inspired a sense of camaraderie, a sense of community among its students. Most of whom, said Lucas, were kind of the geeks and nerds of our era. For many, it was the first time they'd had a clique of their own, or a gathering place where they could talk about their interests, film, without sniggering or eye-rolling from the cool kids. The buildings might have been run down, but they were their buildings, crammed with the loud, clattering equipment, cameras, projectors, moviolas, they needed to bring their own visions to life. Over the entrance to one of the classrooms, someone had scrawled, "Reality ends here," and in a creative sense, that was certainly true. But for many, reality finally began when they entered film school. Lucas, for one, knew he had found his way. "I was sort of floundering for something," he said, "and so when I finally discovered film, I really fell madly in love with it. Ate it and slept it 24 hours a day. There was no going back after that." The same could be said for many of Lucas's classmates who had found a similar calling. The mid-1960s to early 1970s, in fact, marked an extraordinary moment for the major American film schools. A narrow sliver of time that gave birth to some of film's most enduring and prolific directors, editors, writers, producers, and craftsmen. Schools in New York were turning out artists with a grittier, harder-edged approach to film, like Martin Scorsese and Oliver Stone at NYU, and Brian De Palma at Columbia. In California, the versatile Francis Ford Coppola was working his way slowly through UCLA, even as he was writing and directing low-rent horror films for Roger Corman, while Steven Spielberg was at Long Beach State, ad-libbing his own cinema program from which he would drop out in 1968, just shy of his degree. But it was USC that would produce one remarkable class after another for nearly a decade. "I always call it the class the stars fell on," said Lucas classmate John Milius, a reference to the West Point class of 1915 that famously produced an unusually large number of multi-star generals, as well as one U.S. president. At USC, Lucas would be one of a group of highly motivated and talented young filmmakers, all friends, who would have a lasting impact on film and culture. And if they could indeed be said to be akin to the famous West Pointers, it was Lucas who ultimately held the presidential spot, the wealthiest and most successful filmmaker of the group, surrounded by a cohort of capable, clever Academy Award-winning generals. It was an assemblage who would eventually dub themselves the Dirty Dozen, after the 1967 film about an eclectic and slightly dangerous group of Nazi-smashing American soldiers. Lucas, however, generally referred to them all as the USC Mafia. That would end up being a more appropriate designation, as they would all regularly hire, fire, and conspire with one another on countless projects over the next five decades, putting together a kind of system of their own. George made a few friends at USC and decided that's about all he needed for the rest of his life, said classmate Willard Hike, who had become one of those friends, as well as Lucas's go-to writer on films like American Graffiti and Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. There was also Randall Kleiser, a good-looking kid from Pennsylvania Dutch country, who partly paid his tuition by modeling for print ads and billboards all over Southern California. After graduation, he'd start out directing TV shows like Marcus Welby, M.D., and Starsky and Hutch, before breaking into film in 1978 as the director of the most successful movie musical of all time, Grease. And then there was John Milius, another of Lucas's lifelong friends and one of USC's most colorful students. Even in his early 20s, Milius was already a larger-than-life character, loud and barrel-chested and as committed to surfing as Lucas had been to cruising. A fan of gunfighters and samurais, Milius lived in a bomb shelter, dressed like a Cuban freedom fighter, and, after film school, planned to join the Marines and die gloriously in Vietnam. Chronic asthma would keep Milius out of the draft and thus out of the Marines and out of Vietnam. Instead, he would write, punch up, or direct one hard-hitting screenplay or movie after another, from Apocalypse Now and Dirty Harry to Conan the Barbarian and Red Dawn. Slightly older than Lucas was Walter Murch, who had come to USC's graduate film program from Johns Hopkins, along with Hopkins classmate Caleb Deschanel and Matthew Robbins. As driven as he was droll, Murch was fascinated with sound even as a boy, and had dangled microphones out of windows, banged on metal sculpture, and cut and spliced tape to make his own unique sounds. Later, he would practically reinvent the art of movie sound, winning the Oscar for his work on Apocalypse Now and The English Patient. Deschanel, meanwhile, would be nominated for the Academy Award for Cinematography 5 times, while Robbins would write or direct more than a dozen films, including Dragon Slayer and Batteries Not Included. Murch's first encounter with Lucas had been a brusque one. Murch was developing photos in a darkroom when Lucas entered, watched him a moment, then told him matter-of-factly, "You're doing it wrong." Murch harshly shooed him away, but he had to admire the younger man's gall. "That was very typical of George at that time," said an amused Murch. He knew how to do it, and he was going to make sure everyone knew that he knew that. It was the beginning of a lifelong friendship. Despite that kind of particularly rocky introduction, Lucas and the film students were a tight group, all roughly the same age, and with the same passion for film. Early on, they were committed to helping one another with their films, lending a hand with editing, shooting, acting as extras, or just carrying equipment, no matter what the genre or subject matter. And their specific interests could vary widely. Lucas liked the esoteric art films he'd seen at Canyon Cinema. Murch adored the films of the French New Wave, while another classmate, Don Glut, couldn't get enough of monsters and superheroes. "Even though I was going into completely abstract filmmaking, I got involved in all kinds of filmmaking," said Lucas. "And the great thing about being in that film school was there were filmmakers that were interested in comic books, there were filmmakers that were interested in Godard, there were filmmakers that were interested in John Ford, and there were filmmakers that were interested in commercials and surfing movies. And we all got along together." As Caleb Deschanel put it, "We really felt like we were part of a certain select group going in to make movies." They also felt they were better filmmakers than their cross-town competition at UCLA, a good-natured rivalry that continues to this day. The perception, explained UCLA alum Francis Ford Coppola, was that USC produced documentarians, filmmakers proficient in the technical side of filmmaking, while UCLA's students were better suited for producing the mainstream fiction film. That, snorted Walter Murch in mock disdain, was nonsense. "We all knew each other," said Murch. "UCLA accused us of being soulless sellouts to technology, and we accused them of being drug-crazed narcissists incapable of telling a story or wielding a camera. Each took great pride in attending movie screenings and hooting at or shouting down films produced at the rival school." Like all new students, Lucas was required to live on campus and was placed in Tooton Hall, a worn-out all-male high-rise dormitory in the middle of campus, with no cafeteria. To make things worse, Lucas, who had always had a bedroom to himself, had to share his Cracker Box-sized dorm room with a roommate, in this case, a genial kid from Los Angeles named Randy Epstein. Lucas got along with Epstein fine, but he vowed to escape from the dorms as soon as he could. In the meantime, he wasn't planning on spending much time there anyway, preferring to buy his lunches and dinners from the candy machines at the Delta Kappa Alpha Cinematography Fraternity, and socializing over at the film school's central patio, where a circle of picnic tables surrounded a tired-looking banana tree. Here, said Milius, he and Lucas would sit on the grass and try to hustle the girls as they went by. They had little luck. The girls from the dorms all gave a wide berth to film students because they were supposed to be weird, said Lucas. And yet Lucas was weird, even among the film students. He had stopped dressing like a greaser and abandoned the duck's ass hairstyle, but now he just looked small and somewhat nebbishy in a silver-threaded sports jacket that appeared to be 2 sizes too large. When he added his thick-rimmed glasses, some thought he looked like a diminutive Buddy Holly. To Don Glut, he was even conservative-looking, like a young businessman. Others thought Lucas looked stuck halfway between hipster and dude, his mistaken version of Los Angeles cool. And he sounded different, too, with a high-pitched, somewhat reedy voice that could arc even higher when he was excited or annoyed. "Just like Kermit the Frog," snickered Epstein. It is understandable, then, that Lucas was hoping to keep a somewhat low profile at USC. He'd come to work, not to worry about his wardrobe. Like many transfer students, Lucas had to fill his schedule with courses that met USC's basic requirements for graduation, taking classes such as English, history, and astronomy. In his first semester, his only film classes were a history of film and a history of animation. But it was enough. Within one semester, I was completely hooked, said Lucas, though he later admitted that he hadn't known exactly what cinematography was until he actually started taking classes. I discovered the School of Cinema was really about making movies. I thought this was insane. I didn't know that you could go to college to learn how to make movies. Unlike rival film school UCLA, where students were almost immediately given a camera and permitted to begin making films, USC immersed its students in all the details of filmmaking first. They didn't teach you a craft, but taught you all the crafts, said Bob Dalva, a Lucas classmate and later an Oscar-nominated film editor. You learned how to shoot, you learned how to expose film, you certainly learned how to edit. In other classes, students would watch movies and talk about them, or, in teacher Arthur Knight's class, the well-connected Knight would bring in noted directors like David Lean, who discussed his film Dr. Zhivago. Lucas would later compare much of his film school experience to watching a movie on DVD while listening to the various commentary tracks. It was no wonder students in other departments eyed the film students with such disdain. At the time, studying film was kind of like studying basket weaving, said Randall Kleiser. Everyone on campus thought we were just trying to get easy A's by watching movies. For Lucas, it actually wasn't all that easy. I had to take my film writing classes, but I suffered through them, he said. I had to go into the drama department and do drama and stage work, but I hated getting up and acting. I really wanted to be in a real situation with a camera on my shoulder following the action. That was exciting to me. Lucas, like his classmates, was itching to make a film, but they would all have to run the gauntlet of prerequisites first, making it through writing, editing, sound, lighting, even film criticism, before they could begin making their own movies. Eventually, they'd make it to Mecca, a 480-level class called Production Workshop, where they'd at last be permitted to make films, though with strict rules on budgets, schedules, locations, and type of film. The 480, then as now, was what it was all about. Lucas, however, would make his mark well before that, and despite his best efforts to remain under the radar, he'd almost immediately become one of USC's rising stars before he ever found his way into a film production class. All the other guys were going around saying, "Oh, I wish I could make a movie, I wish I was in a production class," said Lucas, but he wasn't inclined to wait. He had already decided that the moment someone dropped a roll of film in his hands, he was going to make a movie, no matter what the assignment might be. The opportunity came in his first year animation class, actually Animation 448, where instructor Herb Kosauer gave each student 1 minute of film for the animation camera and asked that they make a short movie to demonstrate a basic grasp of the equipment. It was a test, Lucas recalled. You had certain requirements that you had to do. You had to make it, the camera, go up and had to make it go down. And then the teacher would look at it and say, "Oh yes, you maneuvered this machine to do these things." While most students diligently put together short stop-action clips or brief hand-drawn cartoons, Lucas had something very different in mind. In his short time at USC, Lucas had already become a fan of the work of the Serbian director and montagist Slavko Vorkopic, a former dean of the USC Film School who had also been a colleague of the groundbreaking Russian director Sergei Eisenstein. Like Eisenstein, Vorkopic preferred psychological impact over straight-ahead narrative, creating complex montages from seemingly random and unrelated images and sounds, some of which conveyed a story, while others concentrated more on mood. Lucas, already engrossed by the esoteric films at Canyon Cinema, was captivated, and watched the Serbians' films again and again. Vorkopic's influence was everywhere at the school, said Lucas. We focused a lot on filmic expression, filmic grammar. I was not into storytelling. Vorkapic's work would have a strong influence on Lucas's student films. The Serbian excelled at pictorial fantasies, like the 1941 Moods of the Sea, in which waves crash into rocks, gulls take flight, and seals dive and frolic over the music of Felix Mendelssohn. The same year also saw the release of Vorkapic's Forest Murmurs, 8 minutes of bears, trees, mountains, lakes, and chipmunks, all seemingly leaping, waving, and gushing in odd synchronicity with the music of Richard Wagner. But even his more story-oriented pieces didn't look like anything else. His 1928 film, Life and Death of 9413, a Hollywood extra, intercut footage of live actors with miniature sets, most of which were cut from cardboard, and a bit of shadow puppetry to tell the story of an aspiring actor consigned to roles as an extra, and referred to by the uncaring Hollywood machine only by an impersonal number stamped on his forehead. Lucas responded strongly not only to Vorkapic's medium, but also to his message. He could already relate to the filmmaker's disdain for the Hollywood system, and the hero with the number as name straining against a passionless society was a device Lucas connected with strongly enough to borrow later for THX 1138. But at USC, Lucas would look to Vorkapic for inspiration for his one-minute film, searching through issues of Look and Life magazines for images he might sweep the animation camera over and across, up and down, back and forth, complying with instructor Herb Kosower's assignment, certainly, but far beyond what Kosower or anyone else could have expected.